It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has the highest rate of African-American male incarceration in the country. We'll hear if a new announcement by the U.S. Attorney General might change that.
First, we're continuing our series on Act 10, 3 years in. All week, we're taking a look at Governor Scott Walker's controversial Wisconsin budget repair bill passed in 2011.
The bill addressed a budget deficit of over $3 million in Wisconsin by changing the rules for collective bargaining, sick leave, retirement benefits, compensation, and health insurance of public sector employees, among other things.
Yesterday, we spoke with Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach, one of the 14 Democrats who left the state in an attempt to prevent Act 10 from passing. Earlier this week, we spoke to Republican Representative and Speaker of the Assembly, Robin Voss, who's in favor of Act 10.
Today, we have a Wisconsin administrator with us who says Act 10 helped him move more cash into classrooms. Ted Knightsky joins us. He's school superintendent in West Bend Joint School District. Ted, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
When you first heard about Act 10 3 years ago, what was your initial reaction?
I think I had to be defibrillated. My heart
this was big.
Stopped because, you know, we didn't know all of the different rules and the different pieces. And basically what it did for local school districts was it took away all of the rules of which we had lived by for a long time. And as a result, we were left with a real void of, well, what does this exactly mean, and how do we move forward?
And how did the teachers in your district react when the word got out?
Well, I think the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of, we don't know what this means, a lot of fright. People were very nervous because, you know, it unfortunately became a very polar piece of legislation, and both sides were propagating a lot of different pieces of fear. And a lot of staff was very afraid that, you know, there would be sweeping loss of seniority, that people would lose their positions automatically, the laws of which we had lived by for so long, contracts, et cetera, would be gone. So there was a lot of nervousness when that law first passed.
And you mentioned the polarization of Wisconsin politics. Down the street from us at the Capitol, of course, there were huge protests, a lot of teachers involved in those protests. Was it still a civil working environment while all this was going on?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, West Bend is in Washington County. I think our staff is a good reflection of the values of our county and in our community. It was something where the community and the staff kind of stood together in the let's kind of wait and see what happens here. There was great levels of nervousness. But, you know, the West Bend School District, I think it was the first district to go off of a teacher contract into a handbook. And 3 years later, I'd like to think that our staff reflecting upon it would feel, you know, that the daily lives of teachers did not change as much as people had feared that it would.
As you said, the old rules no longer applied. What kind of changes did you implement in your district in that transition from the contract to the new handbook?
Well, I think one of the biggest pieces is the labor negotiation rules and how that changed. You know, what we had to do, you know, we're a low spending school district. We have 7,000 students. We spend less than all of our comparable districts. We have a $67 million a year budget. Currently, when Act 10 went into place, we had a budget of $66 million. And we have not gone up much, but of course costs, et cetera, have gone up. So one of the very first things that we had done was we really went to address our health care costs and how we could approach that. Like many school districts, we had to freeze our pace lanes and schedules to be able to work with the new money that we had received, because our budget had been reduced between Act 10 and the new funding formula by $3 million. And in years prior, our spending had been reduced under both governors. But one of the very first things that we had done was we addressed our health care. And we're proud to say that right now, you know, our budget used to be about 76-77% was on staffing and 24% on supplies and operations. And now we run a margin of 70-30%. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the West Bend School District has an on-site health care clinic. We got out of the being trapped in the different health care rules, et cetera. And now for our employees, we offer free primary care for them, their spouses, and children if they're on our health plan, as well as their pharmaceuticals. And it's something we've talked about often. I don't know how we would have been able to negotiate that because, of course, there was an increase in costs for their insurance deductibles, but we can avoid the whole all of those costs for staff by having this on-site healthcare clinic. So it's one of the innovative ways we approached the new rules and as they say, the tools that we were given in the district.
I was going to bring up that word. Governor Walker sold Act 10 in large part as providing school districts and local units of government and others the tools to be flexible and to solve their budget problems. It sounds like you think those tools were helpful and successful.
Well, you know, all the new rules, you had to, if you don't play by the new rules, you know, you're going to be in an odd position. And where we were at was prior to Act 10, I've been in the West Bend School District 11 years in different roles from being a principal to an assistant superintendent, now superintendent. Every year prior to Act 10, we were reducing staff, cutting programs, and trying to keep up with our costs to meet the needs of the contract. And Once Act 10 came into place, our budget was again reduced, but we didn't reduce any staffing or programs. We didn't impact kids. And now our talking point is if we can get more efficient and be innovative, we only have so much money every single year, but if we can move, as you said in the beginning, if we can move more cash into the classrooms, you know, we can sustain and maintain great staff, and we can increase programming for kids and put our children in a better position to be competitive in their global society.
Speaking of sustaining and maintaining staff, there was talk of a lot of teachers maybe a few years from retiring sooner, schools having a harder time retaining experienced staff. What's been your experience in West Bend?
Well, the year Act 10 went into place, we saw a large amount of staff retire. And, you know, I'm married to a teacher. My mother's a teacher. My mother was a kindergarten teacher and was very nervous about, you know, all the things she kept hearing was that were going to happen, that they weren't going to have retirement dollars, they weren't going to be able to have their medical benefits, and she retired. And that happened here in West Bend. We had a large percentage of staff who are eligible for retirement retire. But at the end of the day, what's now happened, because people aren't under 10-year contracts, is when we do have a job opening, the game is different now. You know, it's not just new hires or relocates. It's people who have taught for a decade or two in another community but live here who then apply for a job here because seniority is not a concern for them anymore of, you know, if I leave, I'm going to lose my job because, I don't get that. And vice versa. We have staff members from the West Bend School District who are leaving because they are more in a more competitive position. They're, you know, a 12-year veteran English teacher is very valuable individual, and if we can hire that to replace a retiree or a new position, that's what we go for. So that's one of those unforeseen consequences that is a real positive for staff because they can take their valued services. And I believe that teachers' value has gone up now because when we have a 10-year or a 15-year staff member come in and say, hey, I have a job offer in a neighboring community, they're going to pay me this. We now negotiate that. And before we didn't. It was, this is what you pay, and this is what we negotiate, and this is what it is. And now individual teachers have a greater flexibility in their pay.
There was talk during the Act 10 debates, and since then, of the divisiveness of the debates, breaking up friendships, making some awkward family relationships. You're married to a teacher. Your mom's a teacher. Were there awkward moments there?
Well, yeah. You know, being a superintendent, and my wife is a seventh grade language arts teacher in another community, she'd come home and she would say, this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. I'd say, no, it's not. First of all, that's unethical, and who would do that, and why would that? And my wife and I, you know, I have a great marriage. I've been with her 20 years, and I had spaghetti sauce flung at me a couple times when I would say, you know, that's just an unfounded thing, and no, it's not. And same thing with my mom. You know, when my mom and I were talking, and I was telling her, you don't have to retire. You don't have to worry about that, because she didn't want to retire. She was afraid to stay teaching. And I kept saying, no, you don't have to. And 3 years later, you know, is it better than it was before Act 10? That's up to individuals to say. But many of the things that people were so afraid of did not come to fruition. And, you know, not everyone in my school district would disagree with my comments, but at the end of the day, everyone who worked here last year works here this year, and new staff. And we take great pride in the fact that, you know, we're sustaining our programs and keeping our teachers. Where in the pre-budgetary crises that we were in year after year after year, we were cutting whole programs for students and whole departments. And I hope we never go back to that.
Do you think things look different now from the perspective of your students there?
Yes, because they have a brighter future. You know, they're not there each year prior. You know, a kid would go sign up for courses and not know if, and a family would sign up for courses and not know if they were going to be there. You know, now I know what our budget is. You know, especially being in the second year of a biennial budget, I can very confidently say everybody who's here this year will be here next year, unless there are efficiencies, et cetera. But, you know, we're not cutting any programs. As a matter of fact, we've opened up a charter school. We are spending money in different places. We are expanding programming. We are offering more than we have in the prior year. And a lot of that's due to the fact that we look at the dollars differently now because we have more flexibility with them.
And what do you hear from your fellow administrators, your colleagues in other districts?
Well, I think that, you know, that's a great question. I have 423 colleagues in the state of Wisconsin, all superintendents in different regions and different cultures and different climates and values and politics. And I'm governed by a school board, and our school board and their school boards have different philosophies on how to approach this. And our school board is very supportive and, I would say, innovative of approaching the different ways that the rules were rewritten. I'll sit in a CISA 6 meeting with a 25, 30 other superintendents, and you know, I remember being in a legislative breakfast when they announced how sweeping the impacts would be of Act 10, and all of us, our hearts dropped because we had been fighting to keep the school funding where it was, and then all of a sudden, all these new rules, et cetera. And I think it was all up to individual communities and superintendents. Some are happy. Some are very aggressive with the tools. I'd say we're pretty moderate. And then there are those who you know, quote unquote, don't use the tools at all. So I think it varies. But, you know, the herd I run with tends to say that, you know, if we didn't use them, we wouldn't be able to survive.
Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was Ted Knightsky. He's school superintendent in the West Bend Joint School District.
Up next, we're taking your calls on Act 10. Are you a teacher or a school administrator? How has Act 10 changed your workplace and your job? Has the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill touched your life? You can call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll take your calls in just a few moments. First, here's a look at some of the latest news with Noah Ovshinsky.
We're taking your calls now on Act 10. Call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. Are you a teacher or an administrator in Wisconsin schools? How has the bill changed things for you? How has it affected your life and your families?
Are you the parent of a child in Wisconsin public schools? Have you seen the effects of Act 10 firsthand? What do you think, for better or worse? Has it been good or bad for Wisconsin? Why or why not? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. We'll start things off with Jane on the line in Menominee. Jane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've been listening all week, and one of the things that I feel that you guys keep missing on with Act 10 is the long-term effect. Hmm. Sure, you know what, everybody's going to work and doing their job, and I'm a high school counselor. I work with kids. I work on careers with kids. There are very few kids now that are saying they want to be in education. When I do freshman conferencing and the parents are involved, the parents are saying, I don't want my kid to be a teacher, what's going on, how they're treated, the lack of respect, the political issues that they have to put up with that they do not want their children to have to be subjected to. I think it's a long-term effect that people right now are saying, hey, everything's great. I haven't noticed any change. You're not going to notice the change until this next generation comes up because there's going to be a lack of teachers, and the ones that are going to be aren't going to be as quality as the ones that currently have really sacrificed and done the job. You know, it's like the Lake of Menominee here. It looks like crap, and you know what? Sorry to say, that didn't just happen overnight. It happened, and it slowly and slowly has deteriorated, just like what's going to happen in education if things politically don't change.
And you think, I wanted to ask before we let you go, Jane, you think that a lack of interest in going into the profession isn't because of the compensation changes, paying for health care, that sort of thing. You think it's the attitude you've seen toward educators in the state?
Oh, hugely. My dad was a teacher for 35 years. I come from a family of four of the six of us are teachers. My husband's a teacher, or he's a principal. I mean, we get it. We get this. We've lived through this. We've never saw our dad treated the way that we have been treated or that educators have been treated, to be called thugs. I mean, that is so demeaning and what we went through because of Act 10. And we are all further on in our career. We all have 20-plus years of in education. We're not at a point where we can just throw in the towel and say we're done. Plus, we love what we do. But I have to tell you, this next generation coming up, if you tell someone to go into education, they say, why would I want to go into education and make $30,000 and be treated like that?
Jen, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Dan on the line, also in Menominee. Dan, hi.
Hi there. So, you know, as with most educators, I am a teacher. We weren't pleased with Act 10, but it's starting to seem like that was just the first blow in kind of a planned series. It looks like now there's more and more legislation coming out to fund private schools more and more and defund public education. And I think that this is kind of the long-term strategy of the administration to try to privatize education more and more. And that does kind of worry me.
Dan, thanks a lot for sharing that. We're taking your calls on the impact of Act 10 3 years out. Interested in hearing from administrators of schools or people who manage public employees and public employees themselves. Has this changed your life or is it business as usual as things used to be? A couple lines have opened up if you've got a busy signal at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anne is with us next in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. I was a teacher 3 years ago, and I was actually injured while protesting Act 10, and have been on disability. But I've definitely seen how it's affected our family and how it's affected teaching in general. I have a future son-in-law who would make a wonderful teacher, and he decided against it. He and my daughter both moved out of Wisconsin, and our family, too, is planning an exodus. It's just been really sad to see what Walker's legislation has done to the morale of teachers and to young people who want to go into teaching. But I tell you, from being a teacher and then into medically disabled and needing to use my union to help with that transition, I'd be lost without that union. We wouldn't have a home. We wouldn't have the life that we do have. So.
All right. Anne, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your story. We'll go now to Kate with us in Green Bay. Kate, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you think about Act 10, 3 years in?
Well, I am the daughter of a Green Bay public school teacher, and she's very well respected in her community. She's been teaching for about 35 years now in parochial and public schools. And I remember sitting in class finding out about Act 10, and it was just instantly devastating. I mean, to take somebody of that stature and, I mean, just even the pay cut alone and being forced to take on a second job to provide for your family, to put your child through college, it's more than anybody, I think, imagined. And she's not going to leave early because I think it was Jane who said that they just have such an immense love for their profession and what they do. She's a fantastic teacher. She's a Golden Apple winner. And I don't think that the morale has really increased in their district. I mean, I could just be speaking for the Green Bay area. I'm not sure completely of the situation in the rest of the state, but I mean, in short, it's just been devastating, and it still is.
Kate, thanks for sharing your thoughts. We've got Catherine on the line next in Eau Claire. Catherine, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I serve on the Eau Claire City Council, and I'm relatively new. I've been serving for about a year and a half, and how I see Act 10 affecting, you know, municipal employees is really you've got a set of people who no longer have bargaining rights, and then you have employees who do have collective bargaining powers, and it's just really difficult. It can create this tense environment, and how I phrase it is, you know, on the local level, this Act 10 has put good people against good people. So we have to figure out how do we work through the gray areas, how do we work through the law that's already in place, and how do we
how do we negotiate for people who don't have that collective voice anymore and people who do? And it's just, it's a tough thing. And it's also upsetting on a philosophical level that here we've got the UN that has passed a resolution a long time ago saying that collective bargaining is a human right, and yet people all across our state have lost that fundamental human right.
Catherine, thanks to you, and thanks to all of you for your calls and ongoing conversation. And you can keep it going on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced that he'll urge reduced sentences for low-level drug offenders, which comprise the majority of drug offenses in the United States.
Wisconsin has the highest rate of African-American and Native American male incarceration in the country. The percentage of black men in prison is 13% compared with 6.7% nationally. About 40% of black men in the Milwaukee County prison system are there for the kind of low-level drug offenses that Eric Holder is addressing.
Here to talk about what his announcement could mean for Wisconsin is Jean Gerasi. She's the executive director of the Benedict Center in Milwaukee, a group that seeks alternatives to incarceration for nonviolent offenses. Jean, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what would change under this new proposal from Eric Holder?
Well, my understanding is that this proposal is only going to impact those serving federal sentences. And so, but it's significant nationally because it's not only going to help reduce the federal prison population by more than 6,500 people in the next 5 years, it's also going to really set the bar and start a national conversation for states to follow that same lead in terms of rethinking our sentencing policies for drug nonviolent drug charges.
What was the motivation behind this change?
I think that there's two things that are happening, and it's getting the Attorney General's attention and this administration's attention. One is that the United States has a mass incarceration on its hands, and we are leading the entire world in our incarceration rate. And so clearly, and it's being recognized now, the war on drugs, which has really fueled this, is not necessarily solving the problem. And then the other piece that they're looking at is the exorbitant cost that's related to that, and that it's simply unsustainable. And then I'd say a third piece, and I think he talked about this, is really the racial disparity in how the African-American community is disproportionately bearing the brunt of this issue. And so there's also something fundamentally unjust going on.
Now, in our introduction there, we talked about some of the statistics in Wisconsin, and it doesn't look good for us. We have the highest percentage of black men in prison in the country at 13%, which is almost twice the national average. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of what this change could mean for Wisconsin if it goes through?
Well, I'm very hopeful, again, that it's going to continue to help raise the visibility of this issue. I think that it's been silent and hidden for all too long. Since the 80s, we've seen this mass incarceration rate really spike up, and it really hasn't shown many signs of slowing down. But I think the recent report that came out of UW that shows that we are leading the entire country with the incarceration rate of African-American men. And this new federal policy, it's going to continue to help raise awareness for residents in Wisconsin so that we can have a conversation in Wisconsin about reevaluating our truth in sentencing laws and how we want to start getting smart on crime rather than simply trying the approach of locking people up, which we know doesn't actually change the underlying behavior.
Do you know why the numbers are so high in Wisconsin for black men and Native men incarcerated?
I think that that's certainly the question of the day, and I appreciate the attention that public radio has been putting on this. In fact, there was, and it seems to be that pretty frequently there's a lot of examination. But frankly, I think that if you consider that Milwaukee County is responsible for 37% of prisoners statewide, and you consider that Milwaukee is one of the most hyper-segregated cities, and we have some of the highest rates of poverty, not only in Wisconsin, but in the country. And in my view, crime is a symptom of poverty. And so, and then the war on drugs has exacerbated that, because once someone gets a criminal record, it becomes virtually impossible to break that stigma and get housing and get jobs and get their lives back on track afterwards.
Are a lot of the Native men and the African-American men who are in jail in Wisconsin, are they in prison for the same kinds of low-level drug offenses that Eric Holder is trying to address with this?
I would say yes. A very significant portion of charges and what has really filled our prisons on the state level as well as the federal level are low-level or nonviolent drug charges.
What are the economics, the costs of having such a high incarceration rate?
It's incredible. We are now paying more money on our correction system than on our educational system in Wisconsin. And when you compare us to a state like Minnesota, which has the same population, the same crime rate, and yet they have half the incarceration rate and likewise half of the cost. So taxpayers are not getting a good return on our investment in terms of the exorbitant amount of money that we're paying, and it's not actually making us safer. What would make us safer is if people who had drug addiction problems actually got treatment to change that underlying behavior.
When we talk about low-level drug offenses, can you tell us exactly what that means?
I think oftentimes what is being considered is possession, but I think that Eric Holder made, that there was some reference to trafficking as well, so if you have a certain amount of drugs in your possession, and you might be charged with intent to deliver. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you are high in the food chain of organized crime or that you're necessarily violent or really the kind of people that our criminal justice system ought to be focusing its attention on.
Now, what kind of impact do you see on Milwaukee and families in Milwaukee when you have an incarceration rate like that?
I think it's been absolutely devastating. It's been devastating to children and families, and it's devastating to the local economy. The very fabric of the community has been torn apart. Again, when you have such a high rate of men who are simply disappeared from their community, and their communities and their families need them back home. And what's more is that it's very difficult to return and be a contributing member of society because employers often will check a person's criminal record, whether it applies to the job they're trying to get or not. And so it becomes a huge barrier to being able to get your life back on track when you've come back home.
And the proposal is expected some pushback from critics who are saying that these are people that shouldn't be on the streets right now, and there's a reason that they are in prison, and that this will just release them into society when, you know, it could damage people in societies and cities.
I think people are concerned about their safety, and I think that's valid. We should talk about that, but they should also not succumb to fear-based politicking. And I think more and more, even on a bipartisan level, we can look at things rationally and calmly and look at the science and look at the statistics and realize that drug addiction is a treatable disease and drug treatment is more effective than incarceration alone. An example I like to point out is a woman that came through the Benedict Center's program. She was incarcerated for 7 months for stealing in order to support her drug habit. She received no treatment. So when she was released, she went right back to using again, and she was caught again for that offense. The second time around, though, she was sent to drug court, which is a special problem-solving court in Milwaukee, and as a result, she was sentenced to doing treatment at the Benedict Center. And today, she's drug-free. She's crime-free. She's 2 years clean and now contributing to the community in a much more positive way. That's the difference, the contrast of getting treatment in the community versus simply being incarcerated.
So in that same vein, are there resources in the state that those struggling with drugs can access maybe before they hit the point where they're looking at a prison sentence?
There's certainly there's a number of places to get treatment, but I would argue that we are disproportionately putting our resources on incarceration and not funding enough treatment opportunities, both for prevention and for treatment, even once someone is in connection with the criminal justice system. So I think that we need to reallocate our resources. I think we need to reprioritize how we're addressing this problem.
So if Eric Holder's proposed changes are adopted at the federal level, do you expect there to be changes at the state level too?
I don't think it will be immediate, but I'm hoping that it's going to add to the dialogue and raise the visibility of this issue and raise the acceptability that we can look at some alternatives to just having mandatory sentencing, which is really filling up our prisons. I think that we need to have this dialogue across the state, and I think that it's not really going to change until residents in Wisconsin start demanding that we do something differently.
Jean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jean Gerasi, director of the Benedict Center, whose mission is creating a fair criminal justice system with alternatives to prison, like drug abuse treatment.
We're tracking a story that's affecting thousands of women around the country. No one knows exactly how many rape kits go untested in the United States, but some estimates put it in the hundreds of thousands. Processing the kits of DNA samples taken after a sexual assault could be instrumental in the prosecution of rapists.
This month, President Obama included a $35 million grant in his proposed budget earmarked to help end the rape kit testing backlog. Here to talk about that proposal is Sarah Tofte. She's the Vice President of Advocacy for the Joyful Heart Foundation. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
First off, how widespread is the problem of untested rape kits?
That's a great and very important question. As you said before, federal experts have estimated in the past that they think it's at least hundreds of thousands of untested kits in police storage facilities throughout the country. The truth is we don't know the number for sure because very few states and cities and the federal government doesn't track rape kit evidence and untested evidence. So we don't know for sure. What I can say is that every city or state where either advocacy groups or journalists or victims' rights advocates have asked about backlogs, we have found tens of thousands of them in every city we've looked in throughout the country.
Now, if you haven't been involved in what happens after a rape at some level before, what is a rape kit?
Yeah. So a rape kit is a collection of DNA evidence that is taken from a rape victim's body in the immediate aftermath of the crime. When a survivor goes to the hospital or goes to the police station after a rape, she will be asked to submit to the collection of this kit. And what it looks like is a number of swabs that are taken from the victim's body in any place where the victim indicates the offender may have left his DNA. And all of that is packaged into either a large envelope or a box, and that is a rape kit.
And where do they get stored in the meantime? If there are tens of thousands of them in each city and hundreds of thousands nationally, where are they kept?
Yeah. A great question. The rape kit examination itself takes about 4 to 6 hours, and it's a very invasive process. I think most survivors assume, and most members of the public assume, that once the rape kit is collected, if the crime is reported, that the next step is for the kit to be sent directly to the crime lab. And all too often, that isn't the case. These kits are booked into police evidence and kept there. They remain there untested. They never make it to the crime lab in the first place. And that's where we find a majority of these kits that are in the backlog are in these crime lab, or I'm sorry, in these police storage facilities throughout the country.
So what's stopping authorities from testing all these kits?
Well, authorities often will cite the issue of resources, that DNA testing and especially rape kit testing is costly. And they don't have unlimited resources, and so they have to prioritize which kits they will send to the crime lab. And that is certainly a piece of it. In my experience, we worked with law enforcement throughout the country on this issue. What I also see is that our criminal justice system response to rape in general, and this is reflected in how we handle rape kit evidence, is still pretty anemic. Very few rape cases make it past the reporting stage. Very few rape cases see an arrest, much less a prosecution. It is still, of all, serious violent crimes, it has the lowest arrest rate and certainly the lowest prosecution rate. And so a lot of these rape kits are left behind because we still don't take rape cases seriously enough as communities, and certainly I think law enforcement could do more to move these cases forward. And if they could make that commitment, I think you would see more and more rape kits moving through the system because rape kit testing is an essential investigative tool. It can identify an unknown offender. It can place a known offender at the scene of a crime. It can connect serial rapists. It can affirm a victim's story and discredit the suspect. And it can exonerate innocent suspects as well. And so if you're serious about moving a rape case forward, then you have to make a commitment to testing the rape kit.
Now, we've been talking about rape kits, and it sounds kind of clinical when you just use that phrase. So I wonder if you could tell us about a person who has been affected by the testing of a rape kit and what happened.
That's a great question. It's true. You know, what we try to remember and what we encourage policymakers to remember is that these rape kits, when we talk about it in terms of numbers and we talk about it in terms of DNA, it is very clinical sounding. And I think in a way that allows us to distance ourselves from the real, the stories behind it. And in truth, each one of these rape kits represents the story of a survivor who took a very courageous step to come forward and report a rape and have a rape kit examination done. And that is no easy decision. It takes so much bravery, so much strength, and so much courage. And we hear from survivors all the time that had rape kits collected and didn't hear anything back ever again from law enforcement, that never either, you know, didn't learn about what happened to their kit, or after much advocacy by the survivor themselves, learned that the kit would stay behind in police storage and would not be tested. And that kind of news was devastating for those survivors. It made them feel, many of them, feel like their case just didn't matter and that there was no point in going through all of what reporting their rape required. We also do hear from survivors whose kits had been in a backlog and eventually were tested. And from them, what we hear over and over again is how much it meant to them that eventually their kit was tested, how much it meant to them to learn the investigative information that was contained in the kit, how difficult it was that they had to wait such a long time for that information, and how grateful it was that their cases eventually moved forward. I worked with a woman in Los Angeles named Helena, whose kit was in a backlog for about 13 years, stuck in a police storage facility under the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And she was raped by a stranger, and she had spent all those years wondering who had done this to her, constantly looking over her shoulder, wondering if the stranger she was seeing in the grocery store or at the mall might have happened to be the person who raped her, because she had no way to identify the individual who had done this to her. And the moment her rape kit test came back and identified the offender, she said it was when she got those results, it was the first time she slept through the night since she had been raped. So I think it can bring an incredible peace of mind for some folks. It can help them feel like their case in the end eventually did matter, but it certainly can also bring up feelings of anger and disappointment that it took that long to get that result, and a lot of feeling of loss and grief that it would have been wonderful to have had those results much sooner in the process.
Well, Tennessee and Texas have a backlog in the tens of thousands of untested rape kits going back to the 1980s. So I guess what that means is that there are rapists out there who might be registered in the database, and they're still, I guess, walking around as a result. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's two pieces to this story and this reform. One is that certainly when a rape kit goes untested and a case doesn't move forward, that is certainly difficult for victims and doesn't provide the justice and perhaps the healing they were hoping for. And the other piece of it, the flip side, is that it also allows perpetrators to avoid accountability. Recently, we've been working on a project in Detroit, and they have about 11,000 untested kits, and they've just tested the first 1,600 of their kits in their backlog. And just in those first 1,600, they've identified 100 serial rapists.
Mm.
So, you look at that and you feel this huge sense of despair that these individuals have been allowed to continue sort of to be out there in the community, continuing to perpetuate these crimes, that we weren't able to apprehend them sooner. I think the other piece of it is to remember what else we're discovering in Detroit is that in these first 1,600 kits, the included profiles of offenders who went on to commit other crimes in 23 additional states, so almost half of the states in the U.S. So it's really important for folks to remember that even if, you don't know if you have a backlog in your city or state, the fact is that, perpetrators don't just stay within certain city limits or state limits, and that any backlog in any city or any state can have an impact on any community in the U.S.
It seems like there's starting to be momentum, both at the federal level. We heard about the grant President Obama has earmarked to get these kits tested. And what about at the local level within the states themselves?
Yeah, there is. There's huge momentum. I've been working on this issue for a while, and I would say the last few years we've seen more progress than at any other time. So people get this, that this matters a great deal for survivors, for community safety, and for justice. There is a lot of movement on the state levels as well. Lots of states are introducing legislation to track, see how big backlogs are in each state, and require that those backlogs be testing. And every, you know, a few weeks or so, I feel like I hear from a new city that has either discovered a backlog or has known it's had a backlog for a while and wants to change things, wants to reform the way it's responding to sexual assault and reform the way it's handling rape kit evidence. To change the system for survivors and to make this crime a little bit harder for perpetrators to get away with.
What kind of message do you think it sends to rape victims when these tests just sit in storage for years?
Well, I think the message really is devastating. And like I said, we hear that message over and over again. They lose faith in the system, the criminal justice system. They feel like I said before, that their case really didn't matter, that there was no point in reporting in the first place. And I think it can sort of increase, you know, the feelings of shame and stigma that, you know, a rape survivor sometimes can feel in the aftermath of the crime. It feels like, the folks that are supposed to help them, the police and the prosecutors, turn their backs on them. So it can have a devastating impact on survivors, and sends a really difficult message to them that you may have reported your case in vain, and everything you went through, we didn't take as a system and as a community as seriously as we should. And so that's why my hope is with, it's sort of late in coming for so many of these victims, but if we can show, sort of turn this around a bit, to make sure that every rape kit that is collected and booked into police evidence is tested, and every case is given a comprehensive and thorough investigation. I hope we can turn this message around to show survivors of sexual assault that they deserve so much.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
Sarah Tofte is the Vice President of Advocacy for the Joyful Heart Foundation.
Coming up, we'll look at a major shakeup in Milwaukee County's mental health system. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.